Hi everyone, and welcome back to Safe Space, the Safe in Our World podcast. For those who don't know, the main goal of Safe in Our World is to create and foster worldwide mental health awareness within the video games industry. My name is Rosie, and today I am joined by Sahar Mahadi, Magic the Gathering enthusiast, games researcher, and ambassador for Safe in Our World.
Hello! I'm so excited to be here, Rosie. I get to talk about games and research, games research, and mental health. All the games research fun stuff.
Yes, I know. It's been a while because I feel like I only ever see you at Iggy events, which I think I have only ever seen you at Iggy events.
That is true.
And we'll talk about what Iggy is in a second as well. But it's really nice to actually have like an hour of uninterrupted time to talk about stuff, because it's always chaos whenever we speak to each other.
It's just like hello. And I know what I'm like at Iggy events, because normally when I've seen you, I've been also student rep, so I've been kind of banding about, like doing seven things at once. But yes, now we've got actual one-on-one time. I can also talk about being a massive nerd for about an hour with you as well.
100%. That's what we're here for.
Love nerds. All nerds are welcome.
Yes, absolutely. Could you start by just explaining what Iggy is and how you're involved with it?
So let's give the official title. It is an EPSRC funded center for doctoral training. Now that sounds very academic and very like government focused, but basically it's a PhD program aimed at creating research towards the creative and games industry, and it's the largest PhD program for games in the world. I think we just finished our final cohort of recruitment, so there is now 80-90 of us doing games research from, I'm talking like everything, because it's intelligent games and games intelligence, that's what Iggy stands for. So you have the intelligent game side, which is sort of the AI side of it. So, you know, looking at sort of game AI, audio, sort of the more technical stuff. And then games intelligence, which is more just around sort of the game data, you know, potentially game data, but also sort of the more sort of game psychology stuff, which is sort of, you know, my area of research, and sort of looking at it more of how can games function society. So things like applied game series games, game psychology and things like that, games and mental health obviously being a big area. And they are together with two institutions, the University of York and Queen Mary University of London. And that's been going, this will be the 10th year. So that's a lot of research that's happened. And a lot of our, so Safe in Our World obviously are part of the Iggy sort of advisory board and are involved with us, but also it's just an opportunity to tell people about the fact that games research is happening, because I think a lot of industry folks certainly know it's kind of happening but don't really know how to access it. So yes, Iggy have made a big effort since I started over the last couple of years to really get front and center across everybody. So we have our own conference, but we also go to develop every year, and we're like, hello, waving our good flag.
Yes, I got my little tote bag. I was really happy with it this year.
We've got so many tote bags. There's so many tote bags. And that, I think, is a content. I think until the program draws to a close, and I must say, like five years from now, until the final cohort finishes, we'll be just singing the good praises. And I think our student conferences will probably turn more into outreach and sort of getting more. There's been a TEDx kind of banded approach to the conference, which would be very, very cool. But just a chance to kind of get researchers in front of people is kind of the way forward. And that's sort of been the driving focus. And a lot of our alumni are in industry now. You know, most of the big studios will have either someone related to Iggy or, you know, part of who have been Iggy alumni. I think we've had Sony, Square Enix, Splash Damage, Player Research, you know, you name it. This is just people I know, and I'm sure there's plenty of others as well. But it's a really cool program to be a part of. It's nice being part of a cohort of people, because you kind of just feel like you're a community rather than feeling like, oh my God, I'm doing games research by myself in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah, there's almost like some camaraderie about that, isn't there? Mm-hmm. Everyone's in it together.
That is 100%. Even though if we're doing different things, we all kind of feel the same way, and we all kind of, you know, recognize that we're all kind of, PhD is a hard thing to be doing, and it's interesting to be with fellow peers who you can kind of bounce ideas off, even though you're not in the same topic or things like that, which is very cool.
Yeah, I definitely had that with when I obviously haven't done a PhD, but I did my degree, and it was one of the most difficult times of my life because you're kind of thrown into being like incredibly you're responsible for the work that you do, which obviously is true of most jobs at this point. However, no one comes in, you don't really have a manager. No one comes in to check on how you're doing, to reassure you. Like, it's everything is just you and you alone and the people who are also doing it with you. So, like, I found a lot of solace in having mental breakdowns with my friends. Hey, we're all having a bad time. At least it's not just me. And that, like, honestly helped so much during university. Yeah. So, like, I guess what... Because I know you mentioned as well just before that there's a lot of struggle currently in PhD and trying to find balance. And I guess I wondered if you wanted to elaborate on like the stresses of that.
Yeah, so it's challenging because I think especially so with the research I'm doing in particular, so I'm looking at how games can be a vehicle for understanding times of difficulty. So I saw the pandemic and I was like, games are really helping people. Let's explore that further. And I kind of was looking at, how did games support coping? I mean, there was a lot of research done around that and sort of support well-being as a whole. But I wanted to kind of look at it rather than just like the general population and then, you know, clinical psychology over here, looking at it for sort of like trauma, PTSD and, you know, clinical conditions. I was like, what about just life in general, you know, grief, divorce, mental health, and seeing if there's what games can provide people for that. And that is a very sensitive topic that comes with a lot of challenges in sort of not only the topic itself, but also my researcher well-being in terms of balancing that when you are especially doing qualitative work and you're reading these accounts and you're just like, oh, okay. Plus, as you said, the balancing act of it is self-directed research. You are the master of your own destiny, which is amazing. Until you're like, I have no idea where to go.
Yeah, this is terrifying.
This is mildly terrifying. And especially my first study, which we can, I'm sure we'll get into. It took longer than I expected. And I'm someone who like is a bit of not a completionist, but I like ticking something off. And I'm like, okay, we can move on. And I sort of felt a little bit that it wasn't getting to that way. So for me personally, I took a little bit of a break from it just to kind of like let my brain decompress from that process and actually go, okay, where do I want to go next? Because one thing I've kind of realized during the PhD journey is that you need to take breaks. It's very important to take breaks because you are the forefront of the pursuit of knowledge. You're at the front end of it. So, I fortunately have very good support with my supervision team. So I see them every week. So there is a little bit of accountability, but that comes with its own frustrations as well. Because you're like, I'm someone who's like, here you go. Here's this new thing I've done. Or here's this, you know, here's this task I've completed. And then it's like a full iterative like feedback loop. And I'm like, can we just say it's good enough and we can move on? No? Okay. But it's fine. Like that is the PhD journey and PhDs are hard. But for me, it definitely gets sometimes where I'm like, and especially now I'm like, let's just take a little bit of a break from it, figure out where I want to move into a direction and just get to a position. I think I realized this recently. I was speaking to another, peer who's like a year above me. And he's like, Saha, you don't have to be the Lego set. You can just be the Lego brick. You just need to get to the finish line. And I was like, you know what? I'm actually quite on board with them. Quite on board with just being the Lego brick that makes the Lego set. Yeah. Because there's a lot of research. There's so much research happening right now. And there's like, I'm not trying to reinvent Shakespeare. I'm just trying to contribute my part into this wide world that is games research because it's varied and lots of different factors and lots of different things are happening to a lot of different people.
Yes, exactly. And I kind of want to go into that as well because... what research is being done? Like, I'm curious to hear about your first research project and the stuff that your peers are working on as well.
So my first study, so where I came into it at the start of the PhD journey is I was like, okay, well, There's been research done looking at gaming during times of difficulty by my supervisor, Dr. Joe Yakavides, and they had identified like six broad themes that they could help. So it was like much needed respite, growth, dealing with feelings, and a couple of others. And then like an obstacle to living well, and I cannot remember the other two off the top of my head, but there was just kind of like broad strokes. And they were like, we think that based on this, their sort of first discussion piece was like, we think it leads to coping. We think that game is supporting coping during times of difficulty, and sort of pulling research from sort of understanding about how games can help with that. But one thing they had said in their paper that they published was, we don't really know what game aspects or game features really support coping. So I was like, okay, well, let's start with that. Let's kind of explore what, rather than the player experience, let's look at actually what the games provide players. So I went and did a survey with 130 people. So many people. And I basically asked them, and I was like, okay, well, tell me about experience. Tell me about time of difficulty. You went through, what games did you play? Why did you play them? And what aspects of those games did you buy and did you find beneficial, and what did you find detrimental? Because as much as I am looking at sort of the broad idea currently of when and how gaming can positively affect players during times of difficulty, because I have a positive psychology background and I like the idea that games can sort of be this tool for well-being. And I sort of wanted to look at what is it about, you know, what facets of the games could be kind of broken down and sort of go, you know, is it X, is it Y, or is it just a broad stroke thing? So we found, so I did a content analysis and I found 33 different game aspects, which we were like, oh my God, there's so many. And we bucketed them into about six. So there was challenge, social interaction, character interaction, environment, narrative, and simulation of real world activities. So I'll break those down sort of in broad strokes. So challenge is basically game aspects that basically offer challenge. So progression, grinding, reward, game difficulty, time to complete an activity, that kind of thing. And this idea of like, you know, working towards something, this idea of mastery. And it's been kind of acknowledged a lot in the research. Social interaction kind of makes sense. So multiplayer, in-game chat, this idea of feeling like you belong to a community. Character interaction is this idea of like connecting with the character. I called it kinning in my research. And people who are like making characters and like resonating with that story. Narrative is more about the story and the game world. Environment is just this idea of being somewhere else, being someone else. This idea of exploration. A lot of people played Skyrim. People love Skyrim in my study. Exactly. This is exactly what I mean. People being someone else. And we'll get to that.
Now I just want to replay Skyrim. Why have you done this?
I know. I'm sorry, darling. And then the last one is simulation of world activities, which is as simple as it says, which is people love gardening. People love doing tasks. Stardew Valley is the best example I give of
this. Yes.
But it was interesting to see that in a wider scope. So, you know, and the games that kind of came out of it were sort of, you know, it was interesting. I didn't see like 50 people play one game. I think the top rated game was like League of Legends, and it was like 16 people, or 16 instances. So people could have said multiple games they played. And which I was also surprised by, because I was like, okay, so there's no like one genre. I mean, genre is like a weird, in the academic community, genre is like a very like banned word. It's like game type.
Oh, really?
You can't say genre, because genre is so like, it's such a, it doesn't have any tangibility. That's the problem. So when you say, because people, what Steam thinks is a genre and what gamers industry thinks is genre and then what academia thinks are potentially different things.
You know what? I'm glad you said that, because I have to, part of my job is to add games to our website that we feel are mental health related. And one of the boxes is genre, and I always struggle with that. I have to go on Steam and I'm like, what do they say? What do I think? Because I'll give my opinion and then I'll go and cross-reference it with Steam, and it's always a little bit different. And
that's the issue. I mean, game type, like role playing, adventure, like that's kind of like that's a little bit easier to use, but it's still difficult. So I typically like to use game type where possible. And then so we took those and we're like, well, that's very interesting. And then we were like, okay, let's take this one step further. How do these game aspects then relate to coping? Because we think people are coping through it. So I with my supervision team, applied 5 definitions of coping. So emotion focused, problem focused, meaning focused, social coping and avoidance. And actually just pulled the research from all the coping literature that's been around since the 70s. And we just kind of put it together and we're like, okay, let's apply it to games in a bit more of a sort of detail. And then we I basically did like a cross-tabulation where I just counted the amount of people, you know, what this type of coping strategies based on what they said. And then I took the game aspects and then we looked at it kind of in a big old table. And unsurprising, I just found it interesting, is that the top relationship was challenge and emotion focus. And emotion focus coping is basically saying where games are offering, I've got a full definition in front of me. So ways to experience more positive forms of emotions that players may have few opportunities to experience in daily life. It sounds a bit wordy, but it was the only way we could actually say positive, like it's that sort of what I've called like providing competence, providing satisfaction. It's this sort of, you know,
feel good games.
Not even feel good. It's just more, it's just experiencing it might not even be a increase in well-being. It's just in positive well-being. It's more just a decrease in negative well-being. It's the idea of just like feeling like you are experiencing positive forms of emotions that you couldn't necessarily have. But a lot of it, if emotion regulation research a lot around this kind of looks at that. So challenge and emotion-focused coping sort of came together quite nicely in the sense of like these games that offer sort of mastery and meeting objectives and grinding and reward help with this feeling of competence and having a feeling of more positive forms of emotion. So this was kind of like, okay, this sort of, the research sort of says it, but it's nice to sort of see it together. So that was one. Social coping, social interaction also makes sense, but social coping is more so in other media, and particularly around social media, there's a lot of social coping happening around, you know, people looking for support. You know, you see forums and stuff. There's a lot of like research that's done with that. And actually, not only having the social interaction, but actually having that support network. And that we thought we'd see a lot more of. And we did, but we didn't see it. It wasn't like all the people that were telling us they had social interaction were doing social coping. Some of it was just, I just like playing with my friends. That's not social coping. That's just, you want to play with your friends. That's just something else entirely. So there was that sort of emotional support, but like the practical support that coping talks about in terms of like finding resources and actually finding people to help you. So forums is a good example. Social media, you know, Facebook groups is a big example. There's a lot of research been done on that. That didn't really happen in games outside of people who were like, oh, I found a Discord server, or I found people, you know, I found a guild that really connected with me. Like there were people that did that, but it wasn't as obvious, which was also kind of like, okay, we don't necessarily, these don't two come together as easy as I thought they'd be.
So for those listening, could you kind of describe the difference between just enjoying playing with friends and social coping?
So for me, when they said they were just enjoying playing with friends, I was like, okay, well, what about the game is, you know, you have the social interaction part of it, that's fine, but there isn't a kind of practical emotional support. So, you know, feeling sort of connecting with others and stuff. It was just like, it was just a statement. It wasn't really, there wasn't much more to it. So I couldn't interpret it as like feeling connected to others. Or they were like, I just like playing multiplayer games because it's my preferred way of playing. I'm like, okay, well, that's, you're not really coping there. You're just telling me what you like doing.
It's a preference, yeah.
It's a preference. So it's more about this connecting to others, which, you know, guilds, Discord servers, stuff like that really helped with, but or even team-based stuff where we had a few people playing esports games and they said, you know, that together. But it wasn't as, like, one or two-one as I thought they'd do. The other ones, the last main one, so meaning-focused coping. So this is around kind of people engaging in meaning making with respect to the challenges they're facing. So this is this idea of you know, what sort of the media and some outlets would have talked about games for mental health or games for grief. I like that phrase to a point, but I'm like, you know, people can find stories and narrative from anything basically. Yes. unsurprising, like, not just because Spiritfarer is talks about grief, you can defer it in other ways, you know. Although there's been some good interesting research around Spiritfarer recently, which I really like.
I'm interested in that.
No, they looked at it in how to. There's a lady from the university in Japan, I think, who's been doing a lot of research around Spiritfarer, and I think it's the bear. I think maybe, I can't remember off the top of my head. Looking at sort of how people look at grief and process themselves and their stories through that, which is very interesting. But I looking at that research and sort of looking at sort of, well, narrative and meaning focus came together. So games providing a backdrop for players to understand their life experiences. So a lot, we had people talk about the pandemic, understandably. And my one of my favorite quotes was around Hollow Knight, where somebody said that, you know, the protagonist is a tiny bug full of like much larger hostile creatures, and it's about perseverance through difficult times. I sort of see myself in the situation I live right now. And that a lot of those anecdotal stuff you would have seen, I'm sure games industry folks have seen, that we saw that, which I was like, okay, people are using these games to kind of look at this and, you know, see themselves in the game and see themselves in that character. Mm-hmm. So both character and narrative, I had that quite a lot. And then the one that I got really excited over, but this one I was like, oh, okay. So avoidance is, I don't want to deal with it. Avoidant coping 101, I don't want to deal with this problem. What is problem? And just, you want to have a distraction to avoid dealing with your experiences, you know, whether you're just not thinking about it, whether you want to just not deal with it. And people said around environment, this is when I mentioned about Skyrim, people said that when they were immersing themselves in these fantasy game environments as a form of escapism, and they were very open about, I mean, there were a few people that talked about that, that it, to some games researchers, would be like, well, that's just escapism, that's bad, you shouldn't be engaging that. But then they would report that that is a beneficial experience for them because they need a break. They need to not think about what is happening right now, and it is easier to be someone else. So then you can process that information and then go back to whatever you need to do. And I was like, someone said positive avoidance. Positive avoidance. And then I got very excited by positive avoidance because I like this idea of healthy escapism as an idea.
Love healthy. I am such a big advocate for healthy escapism. Exactly.
I've been trying to find a way to like look at the challenge. Well, I mean, not a challenge, but like one of the things right now is that with this research I was planning to do and I'm still looking to do is to try and bring meaning and healthy escapism into a way to take these game aspects and go, okay, well, how do they link to this? How do they, you know, what do the games offer in relation to these key areas? And that's kind of the area that I'm looking to go next moving forward, because we sort of saw that games provided a lot and there was links to coping. And now we just need to look at it in terms of, well, what do these game aspects moving forward can help to support coping, can help to support or maybe not predict, but at least kind of understand the relationship between kind of meaning and a healthy escapism a bit more. But it's with healthy escapism, it's a challenge because it's not really defined. The construct of it, it's a very cool phrase, and it was written in a review that was like 10, 15, 20 pages. And it's a very cool buzzword, but no one's really defined it. People have tried and there are escapism measures and things like that, but it's not been fully explored from a more qualitative player perception, which is kind of where I wanted to go with the work. And I may still do that. And I'm interested around this idea of meaning and narrative identity. But with doing that kind of work, as I said earlier, it's very, very kind of detailed and it's a lot of sensitive work. Potentially you can get into some deep stuff, so it's a balancing act of how much of my mental well-being needs to be impacted by this and how much of it can it be a bit more objective and look at it more. But it was super interesting, but it did take about a year because a lot of that work, it's like 3 studies in one because I was like doing it in like tranches and yeah. I was like but I'm glad it came out the other side, because I could have just stopped at the game aspects, but I was like, no, there's more here. Let's keep digging. There's more to this. And that's where it's been super interesting, because I think that games, a lot, with people doing work in this space, in games and mental health, so another researcher that I... Well, there's two actually, but Laura Helsby is another fellow researcher at York who's been looking at games and low mood and sort of what it is that games provide people with low mood, persistent low mood, which is different to, you know, which is a different kind of category of like anxiety and depression. And it's kind of its own bucket. And it's sort of interesting, like the work that people are doing and kind of trying to explore this space in slightly different ways. There's people looking at it from more serious games perspective. There's people looking at it. So like Chris Leach, who I know is a big fan of Chris. Chris has done work around sort of empathy and serious games. There's people doing other stuff in that space. And I think for me, I recognize that the difficult like experiences was just this area that I feel that games can really help people. Like that's the main thing. I came at this from positive psychology, from when I did my master's, and I was like, I can see what games could really offer people as a tool to help understand your experience. And I think that that is so powerful as a medium that it should be explored further, because it's been done with books, TV, cinema since their inception.
And yeah, games. But games, they have a specific reputation in I feel like with potentially more older research now, I don't think it's fair to say that it's current, but a lot of people I think went into games research expecting it to be negative and potentially having some unconscious bias on that as well, because they're looking for a bad result so they can prove that games are bad. And it's nice to see a variety of people looking into more neutral zones and how games can be used for good instead of constantly focusing on the bad, because I think we get that quite a lot as a charity. People are like, oh, you're a mental health charity for games, so you're just trying to help gamers stop gaming. I was like, oh no.
No, this is definitely not what we want to do. Well, I mean looking ahead, so one thing that research in this area is ever growing. It's also interesting, Rosie, when I've been to other conferences and other networking events and you meet other researchers and you go, what department are you in? And they're like, history, psychology, media. I was like, there are so many people doing games research in different departments. It's actually insane. Like, computer science, psychology and media, like typical departments. But I've met history people, I've met archaeology people, I have met social work people, health sciences people, who are trying to use games as either a tool or a medium to understand what is happening. And I think that certainly the interaction and the impact of video games is still an area of interest. How you study video games is still an interest. There's like lots of scope of like where the future of the research is going. I know there's obviously so one area of research we've had big success, but big impact in is we have David Zendel at the University of York, and Dr. David, his researchers have come and also done a good work around that, which is an area that is it's still around mental health because it's about spending, and you look at that and you go, oh my god, people are spending so much. Holy Moses, that's really bad. Oh, the games industry doing anything for that? No. Oh, I see.
No, they get money. They get dollar.
Money, exactly. So it's not just about sort of the player experience as a whole. There's a variety of different facets that the player experience goes down. So the government recently actually posted their sort of video games research framework of just like areas that we are looking into. Which is what I saw, and I was like, thank God there is an area for me to still continue doing my research, because the sort of motivations around playing is still there. And I think that a lot of people now, so Nick Ballou, who's actually just graduated and is now working for the Oxford Internet Institute as a postdoc, he did this paper where he basically said that games research, so game psychology research, for want of a better word, needs to be more transparent. It needs to look at it not just in this sort of broad stroke thing. We need to look at it with, the best phrase I've used is in what circumstance and for whom does this apply to? Which makes research very, very succinct and very kind of precise, but you can't just generalize everything you find. As much as some researchers would like to do that, I think a lot, sometimes you just have to go, okay, we saw it for these people at this time in this game. Take that what you will. And we obviously, what I say about the Oxford Internet Institute, so that oh, I had a paper in 2021 that just went viral across the press around games and well-being. This paper was very good, but they subsequently, that lab, I keep tabs on them because I think they're just one of those labs you keep an eye on as a researcher. But since then, they have seen, and the thing that the difference that they have compared to others is that they're using telemetry data, which is like, then, you know, getting that data is like gold. You're like, they're not using self-reported as much, which is like one of the big criticisms. But they're seeing that they're not replicating or they're not finding the well-being effect as much as in that study. Or it's like no effect, which for some well-being, for some people who are advocating for games well-being, I'm like, yes, it's still very relevant and people still find it. But if you're trying to find it like en masse, on aggregate, there's so many different variables that could happen. And yeah, using game time and time spent gaming as like a measure is like a double-edged sword, because there could be multiple reasons, which is why I prefer doing qualitative work, because it's, I'm not trying to say that it's generalizable. I'm not trying to say that it's like for everyone. I'm saying for these people at this time, there's some cool ideas we found. Let's explore them. Easy peasy. Yeah.
I think that's probably a wiser way to do it, because when you look at data more broadly, it's very easy to come to your own conclusions about why certain things, or even just, you know, biased inferences. But when you're working with qualitative, you can actually ask those questions and get what people think. And I think that's so valuable when we're trying to look at personal relationships with games and personal connections with mental health as well. So
yeah,
it's nice to see both sides of that.
They're both needed, and I commend my friends who do and peers who do that work, but for me, in terms of where I'm at in my journey, I think it's not where I want to be. But I find it interesting with games and mental health, because I think that there was one of my, it's not even a critique, it's more just an observation, the anecdotal stuff that you read from the media about sort of, here's the top 10 games for mental health, here's the top 10 games. I'm like, firstly, yes, sure, these games have stories about this particular area. Absolutely. And like certain, Disco Elysium, perfect example. Love that game. Think that game's incredible. One of the best RPGs I've ever played. But you don't have to look at it through the lens of, you know, oh, this game is about X, you know. Like, there are some games that are exploring those topics, and that is amazing. That's why I was talking about the meaning-focused stuff of, like, it is the player, it's a sort of, a kind of, the way I describe it, it's like a duality thing of, like, you're seeing what you want to see, and the game is kind of providing that, or the game is then providing you, which is then allowing you a period of introspection and growth to then look at this, kind of called, like, one area of research that is kind of growing recently, this idea around eudaimonic gaming experiences. This idea, rather than it being just like a hedonic, like changing, you know, one mood to another or one emotion to another, it's more about this idea of personal growth and, you know, transcendence and awe, and games are like really help me and all this sort of stuff. And it's very like ethereal. And I'm like, actually, it's a bit more like substantive, but sure. It's like the hipster thing. It's like, it's very hipster. Whenever I read the research, and I'm, because it comes from like a lot of creatives kind of go into that space. And I was just like, and it's not a criticism. I was just, when I was reading it as a psychologist, going, what? Yes, yeah, a lot of this is here, but also there's reasons why. but I am interested in that area now, because I like this idea of like this escapism and meaning and helping to understand what it is about games that could facilitate that. If there's some things that potentially I could, again, Lego brick rather than Lego set, but if there's particular facets and aspects of games that we can see could support coping or could support escapism or could support meaning, I'm just broad stroking it right now, but take one of those examples. It would be interesting for the games industry, and I think there is a, I call them like enlightened game developers and designers who are starting to realize that games for change and games for well-being is a area they can explore. And I think if there is an element where, you know, say I took this work, for example, and I did a white paper with industry, and I was like, okay, here's like a toolkit of like how you could use X. You know, if you're trying to build for coping, here are some game aspects that you could really like lean into to support X coping, for example. And I can't, now, for the love of life of me, there was an MMO that came out, I want to say last year, that was like, that had a page on their website where they talked about their accessibility, but they also said, oh, if you have any issues, here's some numbers. And I, for love nor money, can't remember the name of it, but it was probably one of the first times where they were like, oh, if you have issues with mental health, you should call these numbers. I'm like, that's a step forward. That is one small step. Like, we will take that one small step. Even things like, though, with the game aspects, this is where I've kind of been thinking about it more broadly, of just like, even if you could, for example, from an accessibility point, because that's obviously very big in the industry still, could turn off combat. Like, take like a JRPG, and you could just turn off the combat. You didn't have to do it. Because you weren't in the headspace to look at combat and like fighting monsters and something like that. Like that, like, yes, that might be a bit far for some games to do, but like, it's not within the bounds of reason. Like, that kind of stuff is there that's interesting. But I think that I've been really interested in looking at it from a sort of a personal experience. But again, that's comes with its own tinge of, you know, when you deal with people who are going through a variety of different challenges, that there's a tinge of that is hard, like for me as a researcher, is hard to look at, because sometimes for me personally as well, and I think a lot of people do this when they come into this kind of work, it's like, I saw what it did for me when I had burnout during the pandemic, and sometimes I go, am I just trying to understand what happened to me to then understand?
Oh God, isn't that what we're all trying to do?
I mean, true that. And it's just like, my brain was just like, oh, that's interesting. But uh-oh. That's also why I've taken a little bit of a break for the next couple of weeks, just to kind of like have a little bit of space away from it, and then come back into it sort of a slightly fresher pair of eyes that haven't been working on this study for like 15 months.
Yeah, I agree. I think when you work in a sort of like mental health related, I don't want to say jobs, but like jobs, research, areas of work, and you struggle yourself with mental health, or even if you don't, that amount of time being introspective or being even like, unconsciously thinking about that sort of stuff, it can take its toll, and you have to be, you know, mindful of your own headspace as well, because like I talk a lot about anxiety and mental health, and it doesn't really bother me anymore because I've talked about it for so long but sometimes there'll be days I'm like, I just don't think I can do it today, and that's fine. Like, you don't have to. It's so important to be able to step away from that and distance yourself from it, because that's
100%. And I think that's something in PhDs, people kind of, it's like the, so I follow the struggling scientists on Twitter, who are very funny. And the memes that come out of just like, you know, existential dread, AKA Tuesday, like that's the kind of, the dark humor that comes out of doing a PhD is very, very funny. But I have to shout out is Dr. Zoe Ayres of Managing Your Mental Health During a PhD. She wrote a book about it, basically. She has an audiobook version, which is what I listen to. And it's very good, of just like managing your mental health. Like it's a marathon, in a race. And I think that a lot of people who are listening to this and are either going through research or going through something where there's a lot of work and you're trying to balance stuff out, I'm like, just take a break. Like, listen, like, one thing I'm realizing now, like with taking a break and actually like looking at myself, is you can just take up the space, like talk to people. Like, it's so important. I know that mental health advocates say this, but sometimes you don't do it, and then you're like, I should be doing the thing I'm saying, because then it's not gonna happen. But take up the space, like take up that space, go talk to people, like go and seek help if you need help. I mean most people probably do, if they don't admit it. You know, I found a new therapist, she's great. I see her on a Monday, she gets me out of bed in the morning, which is good. Like, get, you know, have routine. And if some days you don't have that, that's also okay. You can just do the things that make you feel good. because outside of me being a researcher, Rosie will have seen as she follows me on Twitter that I am a massive Magic the Gathering nerd. Yes. It's unfortunate. I feel for people who follow me for research purposes. Because I am also, yeah, so, I play Magic the Gathering sort of semi-competitively. I have a YouTube channel for it where I create content for older formats. And I absolutely love it. Like, it's actually one of those things that, it's interesting being a Magic player and being a games researcher, because the two together have been very interesting. Because I see a lot of, and this is kind of more just an observation of just like seeing some of the stuff I've read or researched in the wild, particularly around community and coming together and feeling like a connection to others. I was like, that's interesting. And I find it super cool. Like, especially the community, especially because older formats, because they're not as supported compared to, like, you know, Standard, Limited, and things like that. It's just nice finding people. And I think the coolest thing I can say right now is that I could go to most European cities, major European cities, and know someone because of playing Magic.
That's so cool, isn't it? Cool.
I tested this theory when I went to the Netherlands for a conference in May, and I messaged a couple of people from Twitter, and I was like, "Hey, I'm gonna be here, for a week because I'm at a conference. Is there any Magic being played?" Get a message immediately going, "The next town across, there is a Magic event on a Wednesday. We'd love to see you." So I packed my deck and. The Wednesday, I was like, "Guys, I'm gonna go play Magic. Bye." My friends were like, "What?" I was like, "Yeah, don't worry about it.
See ya,
peace." took a 10-minute train ride. I was there. We had a lovely time. So it's amazing, and I'm going to Prague next weekend.
I love Prague.
I love Prague too. I'm gonna go play Magic there. It's like a really big. It's like the big like showcase event of the year. So get a chance to see people. But it's really cool. Like, it's honestly. It is a part of my identity, and it's interesting trying to, like, there's definitely been times where Magic has taken up a lot of my brain space and trying to balance the two. So my PhD also has brain space. But it's
everything takes brain space.
There's so much brain space. Consider brain space.
There's too many things to think about.
Exactly. That's kind of where I'm at. But it's definitely a part of me that I really enjoy. And I think it is so rare now to find, as you get older especially, it's hard to find people to connect with. Like, a lot of people say this, they go, I struggle to make friends in my 30s. I'm like, pick up a hobby. Honestly, once you find any hobby, it could be anything. I found Magic, which is fine. But any hobby, knitting, running, there's just people who, you have common language, you have common vernacular, there are things you can talk about. I have this very funny thing whenever there's a non-Magic player, I'm very conscious that we sound basically alien. Especially like partners, like when partners come to like the pub or something afterwards, and we're like, "You don't play Magic."
Time to wind it down a little bit. Oh god.
It's like some of them, they understand it to a point, and then they're like, they're just smiling, and we're like, "Okay, I'm gonna talk about something else." So I'm not just talking about
you see
that.
Them like glaze over.
Yeah,
like, oh,
there's definitely
no.
been that moment. And like, sometimes it's easier than not, but like most times I can find other things to talk about. Cause like but yeah, sometimes when there's a group of us, it definitely gets into just ascends into, and like I've definitely had the introspection moment of like, we must sound like fecking alien, because also like the Magic vocabulary is like not, I wouldn't say like aggressive, but like kill, destroy, exile, like
I wouldn't say aggressive. Murder, kill.
You say that murder's actually a Magic card. Murder's just a general card called murder.
Eliminate, so, absolutely
exactly. There's a full like the full smorgasbord. Like, well, the thing is to remove a creature from the game, you have to kill, destroy. Well, destroy and exile actually are the phrases. But like, I'm like, this sounds very aggressive to the outside world. And there'll be phrases like, so one of my favorite phrases to say, so in Magic, if anyone's played, it's a collectible card game, trading card game, and there is a thing in magic called the stack, which is basically whenever an effect happens, and then you can respond to it with other spells and stuff like that. There's like effectively a stack. It's actually a very clever game design. Richard Garfield knew what he was talking about. But one thing I started saying, I heard from someone else, which was sadness on the stack, which is like just when something bad happens, it's like sadness on the stack. And then any magic players you hear, you go, sadness resolves. And we're like, no, that means this is bad. But to no one else, that makes sense. But I've said it to non-magic friends, and I am like, no one's gonna understand what sadness.
It's almost like when you reference like a really obscure meme or like a really old Vine, and then people are like, what?
I'm of that.
It's just more like easy to be like, no worries, instead of having to be like, oh well, let me just draw up this video for you and so you can understand, then I'll explain the backstory. It's 6 seconds long, and who would understand that, because you have to watch it like 15 times to get it properly and appreciate the humor.
Well, it's like Potion Seller for me. Like Potion Seller is a good example of that. Have you seen Potion Seller?
No.
Oh my, okay, a good example. Go find Potion Seller after this. It's one of the original like YouTube videos from like the early 2000s, and it makes me laugh every time. I have your strongest potions. I still reference it, and I'm old. But I've fully embraced the sort of millennial cringe that I think like Gen Z talk about on TikTok of just like...
I love a bit of cringe. Yeah, I'm fine.
My Twitter... I was looking at it the other... My Twitter, I was looking... I just responded memes. Because I'm of that age where I don't give a shit. And I'm like, cool, I will respond to you in memes. This is how I communicate.
Yeah, it conveys more language than I can be bothered to type.
Exactly!
So.
I'm much more visual. I'm much more visual person. It's much easier to explain. But I find... But on the mental health thing, one thing I was talking about in therapy, and actually it's an interesting thing to kind of close on... one thing I'm kind of learning about myself is kind of owning parts of yourself, and sort of like, because like, you know, in my head there's like a council. It's like this kind of like, there's all the voices that kind of like, you know, parts of you. But I used to just be like, oh, this part says this, and it's like, no, this part of me says this, because it's all part of you. But when it's bad, it's like distancing yourself. And I think that there's definitely with games and an element of helping you claim parts of who you are and help you express those in a way that makes sense, which I think is super cool with games. And I think with mental health, as we learn more about mental health and as we learn about what media in sort of actuality can provide, not just games, other things as well, can provide people, I think we will learn more about ourselves and how we engage with them, because a lot of it was bad. And like, you know, it's like internet gaming disorder is the one that always like gets me. So I'm like, yes, it is a thing, but also people have jumped
on. It's nowhere nearly as widespread as people make it out to be.
Exactly. And it's not, you know, it's things like that that bug me. Also, like one of the, so it's not in the, but it's not in the criticism, but when I came into games research, I definitely noticed that people were using self-determination theory, which is basically the idea of like competence, autonomy, and relatedness is like the main thing. Like that's how, you know, motivations for playing was like around that. And I was like, this theory is very good. But as a positive psychologist, I came into it and I was like, you know, there's like 15, 20 other theories, right? You know, there's like a bunch of other research that we could look at. No? Oh, I see. Well, let me tell you about coping. Or let me tell you about resilience. Let me tell you about post-traumatic growth. Let me tell you about all this other cool research that you haven't looked at. But it's not even like they've not looked at, it's just that it's not been looked at. The other one also is like flow. Like flow. Oh.
Flows? Yeah.
Flow and immersion are ones where like they had their kind of like cool era, and then they got then they're not disproven, but they got kind of like, you know, criticized and like moved about and stuff. And it's the same with escapism. Escapism is also one of those ones where it has had a lot of research done on it. But it also is looking at healthy escapism stuff, for example, and say, well, how do you, again, back to what I was saying, how do you define it? How do you define it as a construct? Is it unhealthy? Is it healthy? In what context is it healthy or unhealthy? You know, how do you develop interventions for it? Like, how do you, like, you know, if we want to build environments that these concepts can flourish, how does one do that? And that's kind of where researchers are kind of working, you know, again, I think they're working probably like 5 years behind, 5 to 10 years behind the industry right now.
There's a complexity in calling something healthy or unhealthy as well, because like it's not that simple.
No,
like I am sure that there is healthy escapism that also contains unhealthy elements that you'd need to work on to make sure that it's more beneficial for you. Like it's not just a yes or a no.
No, it's definitely a continuum. And I think that's where a lot of the current research around the space has kind of said it's basically a continuum of, you know, we can kind of go up or down on the spectrum and that's fine. But I think that definitely moving forward, a lot of research in this space is, I think for me, it's one of my biggest challenges with talking to industry is that a lot of people find the stuff that researchers are doing interesting, but then it's trying to then apply it in a way that can be, you know, used in the real world. And I think for stuff that is more around, you know, what would be called games user research, which is kind of a lot of what the game psychology work would be part of, it's a little bit more challenging because it's not as like, it's not like my games intelligence friends or like game AI friends who have like a system or an algorithm or an agent that they have built that they could use for QA or, you know, whatever it may be, you know, it's more abstract. It's a lot more like, if it's a lot more kind of soft skilled in that way. And I think that there is user research happening and, you know, we have connections to player research and people like that, but trying to kind of look at it in a way that sort of makes it applicable to the industry is a challenge. And I think there's a lot of good researchers who are flying the good flag and trying to be like, well, what do you want from us or what can we give you? And I've been, you know, whenever I talk to people about my research, I'm trying to be like, well, how does this relate? And sometimes it might not relate, but sometimes it might be like, okay, either it's from like a game design perspective, it's either from a user research perspective where it's a bit more generative, which is happening a lot less in the industry, where it's like, well, who is our player base? Who are we building this game for? Because a lot of the user research stuff is a bit more evaluative, like player testing and, you know, usability and stuff like that. But we are seeing, you know, and this is what I was saying about Games for Change. I'm kind of hoping the Games for Change movement sort of, maybe not as like snowball-y as like the accessibility movement happened a few years ago, but I hope that there are more developers who are like looking at this in a bit more broader idea. And maybe it is the indies, maybe the indies are the way forward.
Maybe
because
there's less red tape there. I feel
there
like
is so much less red tape, but then also it's then who has money? And it's
just, yeah. Oh my god.
And then the story of life continues. But that's I think so for me, I'm enjoying being in this space and coming from it from a, you know, I'm not someone who went like straight from BA to master's to PhD. I did the sort of 10 years in, I did 10, 12 years in industry and then changed into academia like 4 years ago. And then the pandemic happened and I was like, huzzah. Yeah. And then now we're here, Rosie, and doing the best we can, all things considered.
But you're doing amazing work and it's wonderful to see
research
being doing in like the mental health space as well, because like there's not enough and there's so much we can learn about it, and it's exciting to see
there's more,
what's next.
There's more. It's interesting you say that. And I think there needs to be a lot more done. But Laura Helsby was saying in I can't remember if it was at a meeting or like one of our like local things of like when she started, this is like, she's like 3-4 years ago, there was some work done, but then the pandemic like accelerated it like 200%. And now she's coming out and she's like, well, now what do I say? I'm like, Laura, your contributions are amazing. You're absolutely going to crush this. But like, yeah, there's definitely work. There was a lot of work during the pandemic. And I've even been going, yes, this stuff is very valuable, but it also very contextual. Like this is kind of like under what circumstance, as I was saying earlier. But I think that there's definitely a lot more work that needs to be done. And it's just understanding kind of the motivation for playing games during that time, but also the games themselves, in my perspective, what they provide. Because if you can understand that, then that's more of an applicable application.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that kind of sums up perfectly what Iggy is here for, is to look at the specific mechanics that game developers can utilize to be able to make games more supportive, I guess, or just more
introspective.
But then also the flip side, looking at how we connect with games and how we as humans can create different interactions with gaming as well. So
yeah, exactly.
It's all fascinating stuff, and it's all exciting.
It's all growing. It's all growing.
Yeah.
We keep doing the work, and hopefully the people will come. Cool.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you for
joining me.
It was amazing.
It's been an absolute delight. Yes, me too. I love talking about researchy stuff. So I thank you for that. I will link all of the relevant bits and bobs in the description for listeners to go in and learn more about it, because what we've touched on is just a short window into all of the work that Sahara's doing. Please go and read more about it if you're interested. But for now, thank you so much for joining.
Thank you so much for tuning in to another episode of Safe Space. If you're struggling, please know that there is support out there, and if you're looking for somewhere to start, please do visit our website at safeinourworld.org for a list of global helplines, information and support. You can also find us on all of the social medias at Safe in Our World if you'd like to follow the charity in our future endeavours. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.